Okay. Western, have we lost Western? Let's see. Ah, they're there. Okay. Okay, so if we can bring everybody back. So what I'd like to do is two things. One is point to some options and start to discuss them and prepare the way to discuss them. So, and I'm going to try to stay stationary, although I may not succeed. So, Dirac set out a program of quantization of general relativity and other space-time diffeomorphism invariant systems. In the late 1950s, early 60s. It's the most conservative program that could have been invented. The research, because look, we're looking for a new physical theory. I mean, if we want to make a reality check. The goal of this research is not to do, in my point of view, is not to do mathematical physics, although there's a lot of interest in mathematical physics that arises. Does not study mathematical structures. The goal is not to argue about whether string theory is right or loop quantum gravity is right or spin foams are right or something else is right. The goal is that is to find out, is to discover, if we can, a coherent theory of nature. By a coherent theory of nature, we mean a theory which encompasses all the phenomena we know about and checks out, in giving experimental predictions for the whole range of phenomena that we know about. That's the goal. And we're partway through a process towards that, and this is a bit mythological and so forth, but in some sense, there, quote, was belief in such a theory during the 19th century. At least there were some people who believed that they had, with Newtonian mechanics or Newtonian or electromagnetism, they had the basis for a unified theory of everything that they knew about. And that turned out to be incorrect, and it turned out to be incorrect because of quantum mechanics and because of general relativity. Special relativity presents very interesting challenges, but they were largely solved. At least as far as making predictive field theories is making relativistic, special relativistic quantum mechanics. At least for certain kinds of them where the interactions are weak enough. There are a lot of unsolved questions, but we know how to develop quantum field theories to the point where we can make certain kinds of predictions and it works very well. But putting general relativity and quantum mechanics together in the same picture has proved challenging. And the reason why we're focusing on the issue of time is there's a belief, which may or may not be correct, that the issue of time is crucial to the obstacles that we face in making a single coherent theory of physics. So that's the goal. And Dirac set out a research program to do that. I think what's remarkable, and there's a lot more to say about loop quantum gravity and spin foam models and so forth. But what's remarkable is that most of the steps of that program have been fulfilled to some degree or another, and most of them in a way that is even understood rigorously. That is, I'm not the person to do it, but there are people, you know, like Thomas Tiemann, who are able to do real rigorous mathematical physics all the way to the result that I wrote there. So nonetheless, possibly because of the last steps, we're not done. And the problems which face us are the problems of the observable and the problems of the inner product. So in some sense, yes?
When you say the problem of the observables,
normally in quantum mechanics, I know what the observables I'm interested in. I know what their physical meaning is, and I know what the operators are on the Hilbert space to represent them. So if I'm doing quantum field theory, for example, the S matrix, the scattering matrix, is an observable, and we know how to construct it for a variety of quantum field theories, and we know, I mean, scattering is not everything, all of physics is not scattering, but we know we have control over that domain of experiment, and there's a very well-explored interchange between theory and experiment in the context of the standard model about, say, the scattering matrix. Or we know how to talk about bound states in quantum mechanics of atoms, you know, molecules up to rather complex molecules, and there's a very diverse set of experiments that where the boundary between theory and experiment is well explored. Okay. If you ask me, and again I assert I know enough about some observables in general relativity, and it's interesting to go back, I don't want to do that this minute, but it's interesting to go back and ask, you know, given the implicit nature of observables in general relativity, why are we so sure that it's well checked experimentally? That is, you know, is what people have done in general relativity, compute Diffie morphism of range observables and compare them with experiment? Not really. Okay. Okay, and let me just say now at the start of a long discussion, the reason we have not had to do that is because there are systems of interest, like the solar system, which are very close to spherically symmetric, and we can therefore do something which generically would be illegal, which is study a particular small family of solutions which have a lot of symmetry, and use those symmetries to construct observables by using the generators of those symmetries to construct coordinates and so forth. And therefore, we know a lot about, you know, systems in Schwarzschild geometry, like planets and moons going around planets and so forth, or binary pulsars. And because there's so much symmetry in those systems, we can identify not observables on the phase space, that is generic observables for any solution, but we can identify special physically meaningful properties of solutions very close to those with symmetries. And it's worth, it probably has not been detailed clearly enough how that's done in the context of the general issue of observables, but that's what's done.
So is it basically a statement that you don't know what the physical numbers is generally?
There's several statements. Okay. We don't know what the, if by the Hilbert space you mean including the norm, the inner product.
Right.
Yeah. Some people think they know something about it. For example, that it's the kernel of a certain projection operator which is constructed in spin foam models. Okay. But there's not a, you know, you can't write the formula on a blackboard. So there's the issue of the inner product, but there's the issue of the observables. And just again to contrast, I want to make it clear what possibly has its roots in quantization, what possibly has its roots in classical physics. That is, let me emphasize, if to solve the problem of observables the way that I posed it, you need to understand observables as functions on the constraint surface, that is, for all possible initial data that satisfy the constraint surface. Why do you need those functions? Because, well, for quantum mechanics, you need them because you're supposed to make a transition from Poisson brackets to commutators. And to compute the Poisson brackets, they have derivatives in them. So it's not enough to know the value of observables at one solution, or even in a small set of solutions. You have to know them at worst. At minimum, you have to know them in the whole infinite dimensional neighborhood of one solution, so you can take all the derivatives and compare them. Which means you have to know something about the generic case. The generic case is the case without symmetry. And most of what we know about solutions of Einstein's equations are about solutions with symmetry for two reasons. One is that it's possible to explicitly obtain them. And two, because we have systems of interest like cosmology or the solar system or binary pulsars, which are in which the deviations from spherical symmetry are very small. And we therefore use that. So we don't, you know, so the Google Map observables, we don't know as functions. Classically, we don't know them. And that may be, so I want to kind of make a chart of possibilities. Okay, and I sort of, let me, you know, a sort of diagnostic, if you like. Okay? So let me, but I'm not going to do this systematically now. I'm just going to throw out some positions. Maybe people can comment on them. Okay? And I'm trying to stay off my feet, but it would be hard not to jump on the board and discuss it. But let's try to keep it. Okay. Position one. Okay. Loop quantum gravity is right. That is, the remaining steps to making quantum theory of general relativity plus matter can be filled in. There are difficult technical challenges of constructing observables and having explicit form of the inner product, but these are generically difficult issues. They would be difficult issues for the quantization of any nonlinear diffeomorphism variant system. So there's nothing necessarily deep about them. They just represent technical challenges. Maybe we need big supercomputer simulations, a new kind of perturbation theory technique. For example, Bianca Dietrich works on constructing explicit observables order by order in a certain perturbation theory and has constructed them successfully. The quantity that she's perturbing in is the time. So she gets observables, she gets that the longer you evolve in time, the more terms of her series you have to work out. But nonetheless, there's an explicit procedure there for classically evolving observables, not just the solution, but observables on the configuration, on the phase space. So maybe these are just technical issues, and there is the quantum theory of gravity. So that's position one. Okay? And that position is held by a number of people. Let me back off from that and define a position two. Position two is loop quantum gravity is correct through the construction of the spatially diffeomorphism state space. So the problem of finding spatially diffeomorphism in brain states is correct. That is, in nature, the fundamental states really have bases given by graphs up to diffeomorphisms. But we don't have the right dynamics. And there's, is this position two here? There's 2A and 2B. 2A is, we don't have the right dynamics, and it's a technical problem. That is, we don't have the right ordering of the Hamiltonian constraint. There's some un-yet studied ordering of the Hamiltonian constraint, which would be correct and which would allow much more progress to be made. And position 2B would be, we don't have the right dynamics because there's a deep issue about the nature of time that we're misconstruing. That is, and let me give you an example of that. Supposing that in the real world, there really is a preferred time. That is, in the real state space of the world, there really is a preferred time. And there really is a Hamiltonian. And there's none of this, the Hamiltonian is proportional to zero on the states. There really is a Hamiltonian. And if we knew more about nature, we would know that Hamiltonian. And the space-time diffeomorphism invariance is a property of some classical or low-energy approximation, where it's difficult to see the preferred time, but there really is a preferred time. And if we knew that preferred time in the Hamiltonian, we would just do quantum mechanics. That is, we have no, there would be, you know, operators would be functions of the cosmic T, and we would evolve in the cosmic T. And all that we would have to do was figure out a way to measure what the cosmic T was, and we could do physics. And that's a position of a number of people in the field. I'm not going to waste your time with fake positions. I mean, these are real positions.
Yeah. What would it take to be convinced that there is a preferred time?
Well, such people point to the fact that there is actually a nature of preferred time. That is in cosmology, there is a preferred cosmic rest frame. And it's set by, you know, the cosmic microwave background radiation having the same temperature everywhere. And it might be, okay.
But by that logic, there are other choices.
Yes, but it might be that there is really, you know, that fundamentally the diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity is fake. Okay? There really is a system, an ordinary quantum mechanical system, at least as far as the time stuff is concerned, chugging along. And it matches up approximately with the global time that we see. It's a viewpoint. Now let me reinforce this viewpoint. If this viewpoint were right, okay, you might expect that when you looked at a cosmological scales, general relativity would start to break down because you would start to see the theory that was real rather than the approximation to it, which had this fake age invariant. And sure enough, if you look large enough, general relativity breaks down because there's dark energy. And one way to state the problem of dark energy is that general relativity is breaking down. Again, you know, it, after you've spent decades slagging away against, you know, possibility one or possibility 2A, possibility 2B looks like it deserves a second look. And it's again, it's a viewpoint of some, you know, all of these are viewpoints of some people that yeah.
Corresponds to GR breaking down. I mean, firstly, a cosmological constant is perfectly well contained within GR.
You're right. I'm not going to defend it. Okay.
It's something that is said. Okay, we're going to have a workshop the next 2 weeks, and there's going to be 15 talks about modified gravity to account for the observation of the cosmological constant. Okay, and every one of those people who works on those modified gravity theories thinks that general relativity is breaking down at the Hubble scale, and that's why we're seeing dark energy. So it's a commonly believed thing. Okay, none of those research proposals so far have come up with very much, but you know, you could point to it. Yeah.
That time is the proper characteristic of the nature. Do you believe that this is a continuous parameter or it's a discretized?
I've heard both.
what is there?
Let me just say, so that is, you know, 2A.1, 2B.1. So let's say continuous. I mean, the most drastic form of it is continuous. I mean, there is a viewpoint. There's a viewpoint 3. Okay, let me be even more extreme. Because in viewpoint 2, there was still the spatial diffeomorphism in that. There's a viewpoint 3,
which is a viewpoint of some very prominent people. For example, Laughlin, who's a Nobel Prize winner in condensed matter physics, or Volovic, who's a candidate for that because of his work in liquid helium. And they believe not only is the time reparamization invariance fake, spatial diffeomorphism invariance is a fake, and while they're at it, so is ordinary gauge invariance. Okay. And the world is just some non-relativistic quantum system sitting on a lattice, clunking along with a Hamiltonian, near a, quote, quantum critical point, such that it appears to be that special relativity is true when it's really not. It appears to be that there's local, you know, SUN gauge invariance when there's really not. That's just a feature of some degrees of freedom that decouple at low energy. And it appears to be that there's at least, to some linearized approximation, diffeomorphism invariance, but there's not. And the only way, according to them, we're going to solve the problem is, you know, forget all this nonsense and discover that ordinary system of some spins living on lattices. Okay? And you know, you can make fun of that, but, you know, Laughlin and Volovic and Gengshai Wen are very good scientists. And they have gone some considerable distance to showing that you can take an ordinary quantum spin system on a lattice to critical points such that behavior which approximates special relativity and local gauge invariance and linearized diffeomorphism invariance emerges as descriptions of the effect of degrees of freedom. And nobody would have thought, say, 10 years ago, you could do that. Okay. And if they're right, then there is no foundational issue about the nature of time. The world is non-relativistic. There's no foundational issue about diffeomorphism invariance. You know, the world is non-relativistic. There's a time, there's a Hamiltonian. You just have to find the fundamental variables. Okay? And this is a research program that good people are pursuing. I'm not going to state my view, but I will state my view that I'm not going to talk here about spurious points of view. Okay? It's only worth talking about points of view that are substantial and have some set of results to back them up. Okay, so that's point of view 3. Let me mention a point of view 4. Point of view 4 is that Dirac quantization, when it comes, and is somebody writing this down? Because I'm not writing this down, but I'm doing this from memory, but just so we can refer to the point of view 4 is the Dirac quantization scheme is fine for situations where the constraints are linear in the momenta. Why? Because of what I argued, that when the constraints are linear in the momenta, the quantum constraints are vector fields on the configuration space. They have a natural geometrical meaning, a natural geometrical action, and one knows what it means to find constraints which are in their kernel. Whereas applying the Dirac description to constraints which are quadratic or higher order in the momenta is problematic for 4 or 5 different technical reasons. So the root of the problem is Dirac quantization, and then there is a set of subcases which correspond to alternatives being claimed. So one alternative is that what you should do is solve the constraints and then quantize. And in particular, what these people mean, and I will have to write a formula down, they say, supposing that I could take the infinite number of variables, let's say we start with the E's and the A's, and we can make a canonical transformation to some special variables called T and E, and then some list of A's and E's. And the A's and E's could be almost the same, because there really is one T, not one T per point, but one T and one E. And then one of the Hamiltonian constraints, say C of N, you could divide up the Hamiltonian constraints into C of N equals 1, okay, and C of other Ns such that the integrals of all those other Ns equal 0. Okay, so roughly speaking, that means that the C of N equals 1 is pushing time forward, and all the others are just rearranging the surfaces without pushing time forward. And then C of N equals 1 is going to turn out to be E plus some function of A tilde and E tilde, and possibly of T. Let me call this function little h. Okay. And if you could do this, then you want to quantize in a space of A and T, on a configuration space of A and T, okay, and C of N equals 1 is going to look like I d by dt, because these, sorry, I forgot to say these are conjugate pairs, okay, plus an operator h hat, which is a function of everything else, including possibly t. And then the constraint that C of N equals 1 annihilating the state is just the Schrodinger equation. So this is an idea associated, among other people, with Karol Kukács. And the idea is you have to find the canonical transformation that reveals a notion of time. And when you do that, you'll just, the Dirac procedure will reduce to the Schrodinger equation in that special time. And there is actually candidates for T. A candidate for T is the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Remember, well, let me call it trace pi, where pi is the thing which is conjugate to the three metric. So this is the extrinsic curvature. And the idea is you should find a slicing so that this scalar is a constant, so that defines a notion of time. And then evolve is the vector. Okay. So that's a research program that says that there is, in general relativity, in spite of the diffeomorphism invariant, there's a physically meaning notion of time. There's an observable which is time, which is convenient to take time, because when you make a canonical transformation to those coordinates, you get a particularly simple version of the constraints, linear in the conjugate variable, to that. And then if you quantize that, you're just going to get the Schrodinger equation. And you're therefore going to have wave functions that evolve with respect to that time. They're going to evolve you up slices of constant. So this is the trace of the tensor, which is, roughly speaking, the time derivative of the metric. The idea is you're going to choose a slicing where those quantities are constant. And then, and it is true, if you choose such a slicing in some class of cosmological solutions of general relativity, the value of trace K changes as you go, as you evolve. And therefore, the idea is to use trace K on a trace K equals constant slicing as the time. And what? Yes. Sorry, I forgot to mention Jim York's name. And that's a program which would say that general relativity has space-time diffeomorphism invariants, but nonetheless there's a preferred notion of time, which is a physically meaningful time. And quantization is possible in that, with that choice of time. Now, of course, And there's a literature on this. You can go look it up. And of course, you can be criticized by saying, supposing there were two such quantities. After all, there's going to be an infinite number of such quantities. I haven't told you much about, I haven't put any restrictions on what H has to be. So there's going to be an infinite number of such pairs of E and T. And if you quantize with respect to different of them, you're going to get unitarily inequivalent quantum mechanics. To which the answer is yes. One is right and the rest are all wrong. So this is another version of there's a global time. This is a research program that was investigated. Let me try to put this. It was investigated in the period before we had a lot of technical tools. So not a lot was done with it. No beautiful version of it was ever found. But it's an interesting.
On a generally curved background. And we know how to live with that. We just formulate the theory in an algebraic framework. We don't worry about the unitarian equivalent formulation. So in this case, you know, one would say, well, just turn to an algebraic framework and then every unitarian equivalent representation is a different representation of the same algebra of whatever quantum GR observables.
Okay, good, good. So here's a similar issue. So I don't have a response. Maybe that's a direction. There's a related set of issues that let me just mention and that we can discuss. Even without quantum gravity, people want to do quantum field theory on solutions of the Einstein equation, not just on Minkowski space. Actually, I don't even have to go there. Okay. Consider quantum field theory in Minkowski space, and let me just fill in what you said. The conventional quantum field theory that works so well and that we compare with experiment has assumptions in it, as I discussed when we're talking about thought quantization, as to a preferred notion of time. We choose to use the time variable in some inertial coordinate system on Minkowski spacetime to divide up solutions of the field equations into positive frequency with respect to that notion of time and negative frequency, and define the vacuum state to be the state annihilated by annihilation operators so defined. And that defines a class of quantum field theories. Now, we can make a Lorentz transformation, and it's a very important feature that if I make a Lorentz transformation and use the clock on another inertial observer moving with respect to the first, they agree about the division of solutions of the field theory into positive frequency and negative frequency. So there can be a Lorentz invariant vacuum state. And or quantum field theory is defined with respect to different inertial observers or unitarily equivalent. But you could ask, what's so special about the quantization with the notion of time with respect to inertial observers? It's convenient, but I could choose a different one. I could choose some family of accelerated observers and choose a notion of time with respect to accelerated observers. Some particular family of accelerated observers, and define the vacuum by choosing positive frequency with respect to those accelerated observers. And I will get an inequivalent, a unitarily inequivalent quantum theory. It's part of what we're talking about. In fact, there are beautiful results related to that, because if the accelerated observables are uniformly accelerated, then at least if you make local measurements, the vacuum state of Minkowski space looks like thermal state in that quantum field theory with a temperature which is h bar times the acceleration over 2 pi times the speed of light, which is a beautiful formula. And
feels like something deep. So, so for a long time, so for a long time, people worried about which is the correct one. Okay? And more recently, algebraic quantum field theorists like Bob Walls and collaborators have come in and said, you can do a great deal of quantum field theory without making these choices in the context of algebraic quantum field theory. And that's really the theory, which is quantum field theory. And what we used to think of as differences of theories due to different notions of time can be subsumed under some notion of different states. Am I correct? Yeah. And that, and I you know, that may be right. That may be right. Why is that interesting? That's interesting because you might think that there should be a notion of a quantum field theory on a generic space-time manifold, which is a solution to Einstein's equation. And then on a generic solution of Einstein's equation, there's no preferred notion of time. The Minkowski space-time has a lot of symmetries, and in particular, it has symmetries in time, which are generated by Killing vectors of the solution, and they correspond to the different inertial reference frame, plus the uniformly accelerated one. But a generic solution of Einstein equations has no symmetry in time, has no Killing vectors, so there's no obvious right choice of creation annihilation operators. And you can despair about that. You can take two attitudes of that. You can despair about that. You can believe that you can't solve that problem without quantizing gravity because the real Hilbert space has to include the excitations of gravity. Or you can take the point of view, which is a recent point of view of Bob Walden company, which is that there is a quantum field theory. You just have to ask the right questions and not ask the wrong questions. Okay, so all of this may be relevant to quantum gravity, and may not. So I was spelling out I'm sort of making a walk from less drastic things to more drastic. Okay. By the way, I'm using loop quantum gravity because, from the point of view of this discussion, just because there are the most results about it. Okay, I'm not making a case for the quantum gravity. So you could substitute to everything I've said. You could have a case 1C, 2C, 3C, where there's some other version of Dirac quantization in some other variables, and it's the one that you think goes further. Okay, I'm not concerned here with whether the quantum gravity is ultimately the right way. Okay, so. So one was that loop quantum gravity or some equivalent thing that assumes Dirac quantization is right. I've already forgotten, there was 2A and 2B. I've already forgotten, but let me keep going because I'm at number four, which is Cal Kukash and Jim York's research program. Okay. And by the way, if you believe one or some version of one, let me pose a puzzle or a key point, which I think we want to come back to, which is that, and I'm sorry I didn't mention this before, but in some sense is the key point. If we believe one, because we believe that there's a version of Dirac quantization that goes all the way, as outlined, okay, then we are in a situation where the Hilbert space, the norm of the Hilbert space, you know, there's no Hamiltonian. We just have a space of solutions of the constraints. There's, quote, no time anymore. The constraints, the Hilbert space is a function of data on a three surface or related to a three surface. And to get back the physical interpretation of general relativity, we have to evaluate some observables, quantum mechanical observables, which are very hard. So if you believe that that's the way the quantum gravity goes, it doesn't go, some people are tempted to say the following, one of the, but not by any means historically the first or the only one, is Julian Barbour, to say, quote, time, this is fundamental physics. Fundamental physics is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and the other constraints, their solutions in a Hilbert space, an algebra of observables in that physical Hilbert space, which correspond to some observables of general relativity plus matter. And there is explicitly no time. There's just a wave function and an inner product. There's just an inner product on a space of wave functions which solve the constraints. And there's a sort of practical set of issues and there's a philosophical set of issues. The practical set of issues is it's incumbent on you, if you believe this, to really show how the notion of time, which I argued is there in general relativity sufficiently, how it is to be dug out of this quantum theory, because it's not there in a simple way in the quantum theory. And there are some ideas about this which are offered. So, and let me mention two contrasting ideas. So one idea which is in recent times most best associated with Carlo Rovelli is time is really there. Because in the set of observables of classical general relativity, there was time. Among those, you know, those observables of type 2, I could have one of those 4 degrees of freedom be something that I call a clock, and then I'm, you know, just if I ask, if I compute the right observable, you tell me what you mean by time, whether it's the temperature of the CMB or the volume of a slice or the extrinsic curvature, you tell me what you mean by time, you tell me your clock, and I'll reproduce a set of observables which are the values of other quantities at that time. And I'll be able to do that for any time. There's space-time diffeomorphism invariant. So whatever notion of time you want that is sensible in general relativity, I can construct a function on the phase space that measures other quantities growing with respect to that version of time. And I can quantize that, and if I do enough technical work, I can construct an operator in the space of operators on the physical state that measures that quantum mechanically. So there's no fundamental issue. Time has not been lost. You just have to ask the right question. One word, a buzzword that goes along with this is the evolving constants of motion. Because these functions on the phase space are constants of motion because they're functions just ultimately of the initial data, but they relate to a value of a variable you're calling a clock. So that's, let's at least shorthand call that the evolving constant of motion or the Rovelli program. Yeah. Okay, so there is Carlo editorializing in a direction that destroys the picture that I just made. Okay, so well, Carlo, I was referring to Carlo in quotes, the Rovelli in quotes. Okay, there's a viewpoint associated with Rovelli, which may or may not presently, at the present moment, be Rovelli's real viewpoint. Is that, did you mind if I, because that does contradict what I, another point of view, so I'm just naming options, okay? Another option is that time is not there, but it, quote, emerges as a semi-classical level. And what's meant by that, again, I can write some equations. Is that there are I mentioned before the Hamilton-Jacobi formalism. So let me summarize what it would mean. A Hamilton-Jacobi formalism is a formalism where you describe the theory in terms of the configuration space A and a function of A called the Hamilton-Jacobi function, which has the property that its derivatives on the configuration space are the momenta. And then you solve the constraints. So for example, F del S del A, you can fill in the indices yourself, plus lambda determinant of delta S del A equals 0. Del D A times del S del A equals 0. Del A lambda del S del A equals 0. So that's the full set of Hamilton-Jacobi equations for the constraints of general relativity. When you find such a solution, you have some function on the configuration space, and everywhere the gradient of the function is the momenta. So classical trajectories move along the gradient of the function, you can argue. And then you take, in the quantum mechanics, you look for solutions of the quantum Euler-DeWitt equation of the form of e to the I s over h bar, possibly plus corrections. And so this rhetoric goes. Generically, there's no notion of time in this theory. But if we consider special wave functions like this, then that picks out a trajectory, and a parameterization of that trajectory picks out a notion of time. And this point of view is associated with Tom Banks, most prominently. Although other people have asserted it, certainly it's part of Julian Barber's story of why the world can appear to have time if it's ultimately timeless. But there was, the Banks paper, unfortunately I don't have the citation here, but let me get it, and if somebody remind me if I forget this and email it to everybody. Because it's quite a good paper. I mean, Banks is an interesting guy. He's a sort of, he has very much his own independent point of view in the string world. And he's a very thoughtful person, a very interesting thinker. And this is a very interesting paper, in my opinion. I don't want to state my view. Anyway, so there are these two views about, quote, the reemergence of time. And so just to summarize them, there's this sort of Rovelli view. This is all part of option one. There's the Rovelli view, and there's the Banks-Barber view. And those are the leading views. There might be others, and please introduce them if you know of them. So the alternatives, I mean, since the core technical issues have to do with the space of solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint with the measure, the inner product, okay, the other alternatives, like alternative three, alternative four, don't face the same puzzle because they don't come down to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Now, let me introduce some other options. Okay, we were up to option four. Okay. So option five let me see how I want to say. Option five is you're way off. We're way off what we're doing. And we're way off because general relativity is wrong. And it's not as specific as option three, which, if I remember right, was the option of the condensed matter physicist. It's, you know, general relativity is an approximation to some deeper theory, maybe string theory, maybe M theory, maybe something else. Okay? And until we know what that theory is, what we're doing is premature. Because that theory will be so different in how it approaches the issues of time and so forth, that the fact that general relativity, when one attempts to quantize it, runs into conundrums, is just evidence that you're way wrong and there's some difference. And I think I want to come back and talk about that, because that's very encouraging, except one should start to talk about what are actually the options. And this I'll be guided by the audience. I mean, one thing we can talk about is the quantization of string theory and how these issues arise in the quantization of string theory. Because they do all arise in the quantization of string theory. But not helpful, because they arise in the quantization of free or perturbative string theory, and the claim is there's some deeper theory that those theories are just describing solutions of. So that's option five. And again, I think a lot of people hold that option. A lot of people have looked at the conundrums of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and pulled their hair out and said basically, there, you know, it has to be that there's some unknown thing that's better. And there are, of course, you know, arguments that supersymmetry may play a key role, et cetera. Okay. Option six, general relativity or something like it is right. Quantum mechanics is roughly right, but not in the form that Dirac proposed. It might be that some, so there are several, so we're up to six now. So there are several versions of this. So there is, let's say, 6A is the assertion that you can only make sense of quantum gravity through the path integral. Because of the diffeomorphism invariance, there are no states. Because the great diffeomorphism invariance depicts the state of surface. So you've already done something illegal when you start talking about states, which is something that affects time. Okay. What you really should be looking at is histories. You should really be defining quantum mechanics fundamentally from the path integral. And when you do that, new options emerge as to how to deal with the problem. And, you know, among other people, Raphael Sorkin is strong at that point of view. And unless anybody disagrees, I mean, I think we should get Raphael here one evening and have Raphael make the case for that. And I think it's a very interesting case. And again, like any case that has two sides, what's instantly, you're ahead because you jettison certain baggage. And then the other side is, you know, can you make it go all the way? Is there a notion of quantum mechanics based solely on histories which is sufficient to resolve all the issues about what's an observable, et cetera, that is progressive in the sense of Lakatos's research program being progressive, that is solving lots of problems. And that's certainly a live option. There are things under six. Yes?
There are no observables, and we are all part of the history.
Well, I mean, but observables in some more general sense. That is, I mean, we do physics, we extract predictions from physical theories and compare them with experiments. So, whatever notion of observable you need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, option 6B. Let's say, for example, is the work of Jim Hartle and Gelman and Omnes, a number of other people, who argue that the consistent histories interpretation, again stated, and I want to separate Raphael from that, because there are points of similarity, but it is substantially different. Jim Hartle and other people argue for a generalized notion of quantum mechanics based on histories, which the claim is resolves various of these problems. And that's an active research program. Yes?
Because I think, are there actual observables? I mean, you can't do a measurement in consistent histories.
There are observables in consistent histories.
Yeah, but you don't do measurement.
Right, but there's still a notion of observable quantities. What, I'm just listing options. The formulations based on histories, all of them, have the following problem, which you might say is a problem anyway,
which is, it's one thing in some formal sense to talk about what an observable is, but if your observables live on a space of histories, you have to not just talk about generic observables, you have to talk about observables that we observers who live in a little, you know, in a small time, can actually measure and compute with. And I'm not saying they don't have a way to do it, but you know, there are some observables from a history's point of view that are easy to say but are irrelevant for us, like what's the total space-time volume of the universe after it expands and it collapses. You find that I don't know how to measure. That was option six. So option seven is that quantum mechanics is wrong. And I think we should keep that as an option. That is, maybe the fundamental problem is that quantum mechanics is an approximation to another theory, and that other theory and the domain of validity of the approximation, which is quantum mechanics, is small subsystems of the universe. And if you go to large enough regions of the universe, then quantum mechanics breaks down. And that suggests, for example, that you should be able to do quantum gravity in regions with boundaries. So I've always been emphasizing we're discussing space-times with no spatial boundaries, which are spatially compact. If there are boundaries, again, this is a long subject which is worthy of a course in itself, but if you want to study a system in general relativity with a boundary, for example, asymptotically flat, or for example, just, you know, consider the gravitational degrees of freedom inside this can, the degrees of freedom of the classical quantum geometry inside this can. Well, then you break the diffeomorphism invariance by defining the boundaries, and you can put observables on boundaries. I can ding the can and measure the gravitational waves zinging across the can, and I can construct lots of observables, and this, some of this has been done in a lot of detail, on boundaries, and there's also a Hamiltonian, because I can have a clock outside the can, and I can measure the evolution of the quantum state of the can with respect to a clock outside of it. And so I can have a notion of time externally imposed. I can have observables living on the boundaries. And I'm doing conventional quantum mechanics. There is even a point of view. So let me call this point of view 8. There's a point of view that that there is only quantum mechanics for subsystems. So this point of view is most forcefully due to Lewis Crane, and in some papers in the early 90s. And Lewis argued that that you don't have a quantum state associated with a compact region of space-time, with compact space-time, but let's see, let me draw a two-dimensional picture. So that's the sphere. For every way of introducing a boundary into space, so this is a 2+1-dimensional world, which is a sphere across time. For every way of introducing a boundary, there is a Hilbert space of states on the boundary. And you want a theory which is going to tell you about how you map between those Hilbert spaces when you move the boundary around. And this point of view, so this is Crane's point of view. This has a beautiful mathematical language in terms of categories. So this is sort of called categorical quantum gravity. And it's a beautiful picture, and again, it's something that I could talk about, something that I spent a lot of time on thinking about. And then, by definition, the observables live in the Hilbert spaces which are brought to life by the boundary, and a quantum theory is not, from this point of view, one Hilbert space. It is a functor that, for every way of introducing a boundary into a compact space, gives the Hilbert space as an algebra of observables. And something that's very cool is that there's actually two Hilbert spaces. There's one on each side. And it's part of the axioms of this approach to quantum gravity that they're related by Hermitian conjugation, which means that you take a state from here and a state from here, and you put them together, and you have a number, which is in a product. So basically, you have, what you're doing is you're taking inner products between states that live, that reflect information to one side, and states that reflect information to the other side. Mm-hmm. They're like dual spaces, yeah. And there's a beautiful picture there, and if there's interest, I can come back and talk about it. It's interesting that a very similar point of view was proposed about a year later by Gerard et al., which is called the holographic principle. And Gerard's idea is usually presented in a form that's not so clear, because he also doesn't believe in quantum mechanics, so he believes that this is a way to the deeper theory behind quantum mechanics. But there's a lot of interesting similarities between the categorical research, and this has led to a research program, and for mathematicians, a lot of people have worked on it. A number of mathematicians, like John Baez and so forth, have worked on versions of this. And it's reflected in some of the languages, string flow models. Some of the mathematical tools come from that. And there's an interesting synergy with the Tuff argument, which Archer very similarly. Tuff says that the quantum state of a system, which is the Morphism invariant, can only live on a boundary where you're making observations of it. Basically, he sort of has a picture that because of diffeomorphism invariance, you can't make sense of where anything is in the interior. Now, in certain sense, we know better, because we know you could complicated ways make sense of that. But he argues for that, whereas on a boundary, you're going to know what observables are. So that's a point of view, which again has a research program associated with it, and related to that, and I'm going to start running out of things to mention, which is good. But let me just say, related to that, there's a sense among some mathematicians and mathematical physicists that what's needed in moving from quantum mechanics to quantum gravity is the introduction of a kind of context dependence. That if there's not a Hilbert space, there's a category of Hilbert spaces which have a functor which maps them to a category of subspaces of a manifold. And that to define quantum mechanics in this context where there isn't a background metric, there isn't an external notion of time, is a kind of contextualization. I mean, we already have contextualization in quantum mechanics. There's kind of a further contextualization. And so, for example, the questions, if I'm in a space-time, the questions that I can answer are questions about my backward light cone. So my algebra of observables that I can measure are an algebra of observables which incompletely specify it turns out there's no observable, there's no event, finite event in a typical solution, cosmological solution of the Einstein equation, this backward light cone sees a whole three-dimensional surface. So that means that any observer really effectively has an algebra of observables that they can work with, which is incomplete. And different observers have different incomplete algebra of observables. So this suggests, and for example, this is Fotini Markopoulos' work at some point. This suggests the application of intuitionistic logic, that there should be an algebra of observables that even classically are valued in some intuitionistic logic because a given observer can only give truth values to a subset of the observables. And the set of observables of the theory that a given observer can give truth values to are a subset. They're a subset that will grow in time because your backward light cone is more encompassing in the same way that, oh my God, it's not hiding, the original Brouwer talked about the set of propositions that could be given truth values to growing in time as the mathematician works more. And so there's a mathematical analogy there, which became a research program. And the mathematical language of this research program grew from, so there's a sort of more sophisticated version of intuitionistic logic, which goes under the name of topos theory, which is a way of introducing more generally context dependence into logic, that is, you want to deal with situations in which the set of truth values that can be given to propositions depend on something about the context of the who is giving the truth values. And so that became a program in quantum gravity where causal structure is built in because who can give what truth values depends on the causal structure. And that, in turn, is related to the work of Chris Isham. And in some sense, this idea is inspired by early work of Chris Isham, but now really developing work of Andreas Doring, where they argue that topos theory, because of the way you can introduce context dependence, is the right language for quantum gravity and quantum space. I'm not going to say anything more about that, but we have a talk by Andreas Doring next week, who I very much hope will clearly introduce. This is not easy stuff, but I very much hope that he will introduce it. And it's based on the idea that Chris Isham has had for a long time, which is that there's a kind of radical redefinition of quantum mechanics that's needed to introduce context dependence, a deeper form of contextualization. Okay, so that's a range of options. And within those range of options, somewhere might be the right option, that is the one that actually corresponds to nature, or to say it a little bit less romantically, corresponds to the framework that will be the framework for the next important advance in physics. I don't want to say nature is ultimately this or ultimately that. And it's a big range of options. And at issue for anybody doing research in this field is how you choose amongst the range of options that you think are plausible and you invest your time into. And the different options have implications for the issue of time and the role of time in physics and vice versa. So as we go on, I want to focus on the question of time and the very closely related question of, you know, what are the options for quantum gravity and quantum cosmology? And the discussion goes two ways. If you think on technical grounds, you can rule out some options. You make less, I don't want to say rule out, but you make less plausible some more conceptual or philosophical notion of time. So, there's not a simple one-to-one relationship between the philosophical options and the physics options, and I don't expect there ever is or ever was, but there's certainly a lot of interplay. Okay, questions, discussion? Okay, so so this closes the more technical part of the course. What I'm going to do next time is go back, and I'm going to do it in a way which the experts will not be very satisfied with, but I'm going to go in back to Newton and Leibniz and paint the cartoon of the Newtonian point of view versus the Leibnizian point of view as a starting point for language to talk about the different philosophical ideas about time. And I'm very frightened as to how this is going to turn out, because I'm conscious that there are good philosophers who are going to, you know, take issue with how I do all of this. So we'll see how this goes, but we'll give you guys a chance to, you won't be here. Well, you'll be here again before the end of the course. Yeah. Yeah.
Space for questions.
Yeah, sure.
The one option that really seems to be quite distinct from all the others, namely emergent gravity and the emergent theory of gravity, is that, unless I'm very much mistaken, it doesn't call for GR to be quantized.
Yeah, so
where
so just to get the language, so emergent gravity is what I was referring to when I said there's a condensed matter physics system, and gravity is a description, a phenomenological description of one phase or one quantum critical point. Yes.
But where does that leave? I mean, you may not believe it, but insofar as it's coherent, where does that leave the traditional arguments that GR must be quantized?
Maybe we should examine those traditional arguments. So, to my knowledge, nobody has invented a thought experiment that would force us to believe that gravity is quantized, that space-time is quantized, of the following form. So, the ultraviolet catastrophe is plausibly an argument that classical electromagnetism is inconsistent with the existence of atoms and statistical physics and thermodynamics. We can argue the ins and outs, and you know much more of this than I do, but there was certainly an argument which was persuasive to some people at the time that the absence of an ultraviolet catastrophe meant that there had to be a modification of the laws of physics at a very fundamental level. Am I right? I mean, certainly yeah. Ehrenfest and Einstein and other people pushed that argument very hard. Okay. So, for example, that argument fails in the context of gravity, which I'd be happy to say, this should be a way I could sketch in a minute why it fails. Okay. And that's an interesting fact. And I'm unaware of any similar argument that when you really examine it succeeds. So let me examine why the ultraviolet catastrophe argument is. So the ultraviolet catastrophe argument is, I invent a container for electromagnetic radiation by, I build walls out of conductors. I can keep electromagnetic radiation confined for an arbitrary long period of time. I heat the walls up. There's an exchange of energy between the walls and the radiation. And if I apply classical statistical mechanics to the modes of the field inside the box, I don't, there's no equilibrium. Nonetheless, I open a pinhole and light comes out in equilibrium and with a particular curve. Okay. So what happens when you set up the problem in general relativity? You start worrying about what the walls of the container are made of. And you start computing the efficiency of transmission of the wall
through an impeding gravitational wave. This was first done by Freeman Dyson, and it was later done by other people, and I can give references later. I had some papers about this. But so you have some wall, it has some density, it has some thickness L, you can assume it's very big, and some gravitational radiation is impinging on it. And you're measuring the efficiency, which is the amount of energy that is transmitted. And what you can show is a bound, like the efficiency is bounded by the speed of sound over the speed of, in the material, over the speed of light to some high power. I don't remember what it's due. Another factor is the Schwarzschild radius of the material. So this is a function of mu, which I don't remember what function. It's a function of g mu over L, again, to some power, like squared. So the answer is, so the conclusion is that if this is a physical, this is a material where the speed of sound is less than the speed of light, and where it is not yet collapsed to a black hole, the efficiency is much less than one. And therefore, you can't contain the gravitational radiation for a time longer than the light crossing time. So there's a bunch of arguments which all end up that way. You might say, oh, well, that's OK. We have the universe. So we're going to thermalize gravitational radiation in the universe. So I use the language of gravitons to make this. This is not really about gravitons, but I use the language of gravitons. So there's a big bang. The universe is expanding. The temperature is decreasing. Here's a gravitational wave. Let me say it classically. There's we're at some time t, and there is a time tau such that after time tau, most of the energy in the gravitational wave will have scattered with material in the universe or with other gravitational waves. Okay, and you can show that the positivity of the energy momentum tensor. I think that's right. Together with the Einstein equations, tells you that tau is always greater than t. So no matter how long you wait in the universe, gravitational radiation will not thermalize. And so there does not appear to be an ultraviolet catastrophe for gravitational radiation. One might have thought there was. And these arguments got quite, it was a little exchange of papers. This was sometime back in the early 80s. And the arguments got quite convoluted. So Bob Wald said, wait a minute, I can take a charged shell at the extremal limit where the charge in the right unit is equal to the mass. And I can construct a potential that confines gravitational waves. So I have this sort of charged shell. It's not a black hole. It's slightly bigger than it would be if it was a black hole. And this thing indeed makes a potential where gravitational waves slosh back and forth in it. And you can maintain gravitational waves confined for as long as you like. And then John Dell computed the effect of the gravitational waves sloshing through on the shell and proved that the shell would always collapse from instability set up by the gravitational waves before they thermalized. So now, do you think that's interesting? I mean,
it begs the question, if we're going to adopt the Dirac quantization procedure or something like it, we should have a very good reason for doing this.
And maybe we don't.
And maybe we don't.
Maybe we don't, yes.
I mean, there's even a more radical view. I mean, Rosenfeld felt that very strongly in the Copenhagen camp, following Bohr, right? Why should you even think about quantizing gravity? It's not the kind of thing you should think about quantizing. It just deals with macroscopic systems. You don't need it. You don't need a quantum theory for it the way we do for other kind of phenomena. Now, that's adopting a very particular interpretation of quantum mechanics that gets you to that view, but nonetheless.
Sure. And
if general relativity is emergent, and let me say, general relativity could be emergent from a system that was just a whole bunch of, you know, the dumbest things some fixed lattice like Laughlin and Bolovic look like, but general relativity could be emergent from a system not defined, you know, in some background that we know about. It could be emergent from some. So there's a set of works called quantum gravity where it's argued that space is emergent from just the quantum dynamics of graph. And so saying that general relativity is emergent is a rather generic thing to do. But what you mean is emergent from something which was not the quantization of general relativity or any other theory, some quantum mechanical discrete system, some bunch ultimately of qubits with the Hamiltonian tying them together. Sure. So you don't get away entirely from this. So let me raise one issue, which is really about special relativity. If special relativity is emergent, if there really is just, as Laughlin imagines, you know, some rest frame where there's a whole bunch of spins interacting with each other on the lattice, that rest, then as you propagate photons through that, you're going to see dispersion, and by measuring that dispersion, you're going to see a breakdown of special relativity. And what is known rather recently is that if that dispersion is first order in energy, so what I mean by that is if E squared is T squared plus the lattice spacing for his thing times E cubed or T cubed, doesn't matter. So that's linear. So what's believed is that, there are two cases. Since I have only 1 minute, I won't explain it, but it's most likely, if this is true, that the sign of this effect depends on parity. That left-handed photons have a different effect than right-handed photons, which you get basically by dimensional analysis. The simplest thing that could happen that could cause such a term in an effective Hamiltonian is parity on. It's a term in the Hamiltonian of the form of E dot L cross B. So that would make a parity odd contribution to Maxwell's equation. So that is ruled out up to A much smaller than the Planck length by about 5 orders of magnitude. And it's very remarkable that it's ruled out. It's ruled out because it causes rotations of planes of polarization. And by observations of polarized radio signals from radio galaxies, which we know how far they are away because we know the redshift, that is ruled out way past the quantum gravity scale, which is a remarkable fact. If it's parity even, it's not yet ruled out. But it's on the boundary of being ruled out. There's even a claim it's been seen by the magic experiment, who studied TeV photons coming from a blazar called Markovian 501, and they claim that the bluer photons arrive 4 minutes later on the average than the redder photons from this very discrete sudden event. And no sane astrophysicist I've talked to thinks that that's real. But it happens to be that if you plug that time of 4 minutes, because we know the distance to this thing, into this formula, you get A of about the Planck length. So it could, if the experiment is right, it could be the observation of a dispersion disagreeing with special relativity. The most likely explanation is that it's just a spurious result experimentally. The second most likely explanation is that the hotter photons left the event slightly after the cooler photons, because this is, you know, this is a big, huge million solar mass black hole. No, it's a jet coming out of a big million solar mass black hole, okay, accelerating some things at us, and the whole thing is a lot bigger than 4 light minutes across. So, believed to be, I mean, these are models. So it's, if it is a real event effect, it's probably not a quantum gravity effect. But nonetheless, what this shows is that the effect could be seen by present technology. The same effect in gamma rays from gamma ray bursts is now bounded, because we see one gamma ray burst a day from the gamma ray burst. So from gamma ray bursts, it's bounded as to less than about 1,000 Planck lengths. And the future observations from, for example, the GLASS satellite are hoped to bound it to sort of order one. So maybe. Okay. Last question.
General limit, like from the size of the objects, where you get like those transform and the size of the universe that you cannot rule out some precision. If you have like a minimum size of a typical object, say whatever black hole is, and if you have a maximum distance, then you could actually set a minimum for the precision of A, which you can achieve.
Right, so a way to ask the question is, if we know the distance to gamma ray bursts, and there is such an equation, there would be have to be a shortest gamma ray burst as a function of distance. Okay, and that's part of where these bounds come from, is by looking for the shortest gamma ray bursts. Gamma ray bursts have big ranges from, I think, thousands of seconds to hundreds of seconds. Unfortunately, we don't know the redshift to most of them, but occasionally we see one that we know the redshift to. So anyway, so it's possible. It's not ruled out yet. Okay, let's stop for now. Thank you.